Hi, everyone, and welcome to this latest installment of the UKIS ITEL podcast. Before I introduce our guests, let me just alert you to the fact that next week we've got a special on this podcast, which is our discussion of the results of the by-elections. But without further ado, let me say our guest this week is Ben Judah. Ben's a British-French author and journalist. He's the author of three acclaimed books, Fragile Empire, which is a book about Russia and Vladimir Putin, This is London in 2016, and his latest book, which I'm holding up even though you can't see it, is This is Europe, The Way We Live Now. Ben, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Actually, I should also mention the fact that Ben is a think tanker and director of the Transform Europe Initiative at the Atlantic Council. There we go. That's all your biography there.
Terrific. Now,
let's talk about the book, if we can start with that. I mean, it's an amazingly rich and complex book. I mean, let's just start with this. Give us an abstract. Just describe to our listeners what the book is and what it does.
Well, the book's an attempt to write a book about modern Europe. It's an attempt to put a continent into a book and also to break very consciously with a lot of traditional travel writing and Europe writing. So what I decided to do was not to have me as a journalist narrator sort of wandering around Europe, telling you what I think and introducing you to people and politicians, and to have each chapter written as closely as possible from the point of view of one of the people or the characters or the subjects in the book. Each chapter is written like a short story with quotes, which is then checked back with them to make sure everything's kind of fully accurate. So the book reads like a journey along the arc of life through modern Europe, from people in their teens all the way to people facing death, from all over the continent, from all over its sort of major recognisable regions, its classes, its races, its different genders, and all kind of aspects of sexual diversity. And it's trying to capture how we live now. It's trying to show that the way we live in modern Europe has been profoundly changed over the last few decades into something very different.
Yeah, and reading them, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? I won't say isn't it, because you'd have to agree. But you really get this sense of other people's perspectives reading the book. I mean, you say it's a book about Europe, and I'm so sad that when someone says to me a book about Europe, I expect a book about the sort of policy-making process of the European Union. And this is about as far away as you can get from that. But what made you, because it's not the first time you've done this, is it? Your London book is a bit like this. What made you suddenly think, actually, I don't want to be a narrator, I'm going to let other people narrate? Was there something that sort of flicked a switch in your mind? Was it a book you read that you thought, hang on, this is the wrong way of doing things?
So I wrote this book called This is London, and the This is London's about contemporary British capital. It's about the city that I grew up in, and I'd worked as a foreign correspondent in Russia, and I'd been physically and mentally in Russia for several years. And when I came back, I felt that London had really become a different place since I'd really been sort of paying attention to it. And I wanted to tell the story about how London had really become an immigrant city, a kind of modern global city. And I wrote this quite sort of semi-conventional book in which I wander around London for a page or two, and then I introduce you to a character and a person, and then snap, you're under. You're kind of meeting them. And after I finished This is London, I decided that I wanted to write at first a book about France. So I went to France, I wandered around France, and I wrote 40,000 to 50,000 words of a book that I hated. And I hated the way it was written, I hated the sound of my own voice, I thought it was boring, and I X'd out of it and decided, God, I've got to do something completely different. So I went to the drawing board and I thought, what's going wrong here? And I thought the main thing that was going wrong there was actually me, was this narrator. Because it just felt completely old-fashioned and stale to have a sort of British or Franco-British bloke kind of wandering around Europe, meeting people and sort of introducing them and telling you sort of what he thinks. And it felt like a kind of imitation of a style of travel writing, which is really very post-colonial or post-war. It's V.S. Naipaul and Paul Theroux sort of wandering around Africa and the subcontinent. It's, you know, Nicolas Bouvier and L'Usage du Monde in French. It just felt kind of worn out and tired, and it felt kind of irrelevant, actually, almost like it was getting in the way of the interesting stuff. Because what's interesting about me describing what it's like to take an EasyJet or get the Eurostar or wander past the Colosseum? Well, nothing, because we live in a kind of mass travel age. We live in an age saturated by Instagram on Threads and Twitter and images. And you're at my initial superficial perspective on wandering around Paris is probably the same as yours or the same as countless other listeners or readers. And I thought, this is just not interesting. What is interesting is the point of view of the people that I'm going to meet. It's the point of view of the subjects. Yep. It's the point of view of the people who are being interviewed. And why do I need to get in the way of that? I don't need to be in the way of that. These people should, there should be no me. We should have go from chapter to chapter, you know, immediately listening to them and kind of being as close as possible sort of with them. And that was main insight.
But just to butt in on that, I mean, did you have an agenda? I mean, were there themes that you wanted to get people to talk about? Or did you literally go into this and say, I'm going to talk to loads of people and let their stories unfold, whatever they might be and whatever they might be about?
Well, I had a sort of literary agenda, I guess, is that I wanted to kill the narrator and see what happened. I wanted to write a book without a narrator. Each chapter's, you know, written from as close as possible from their point of view, or it's a reconstruction of their point of view journalistically. I wanted to invite each of them to contribute photos to the book. So it's like they've sent you a text or a WhatsApp. I wanted to create the most immersive book possible. Then I had a kind of sociological agenda, is I wanted to write a book that was 50-50, male, female, that represented Europe's kind of sexual diversity, that had all of the main regions and classes and the main themes in it. I wanted it to capture a lot of the themes of what I felt were the great transformations of Europe happening right now. And those are immigration, which is changing every city and also every rural community. Technology, like the algorithms really there behind every human interaction we have.
Yep.
Supply chains, how that behind every product, there's an incredible human and machine chain leading to this thing being on your table. War, not just the war in Ukraine, which is changing the continent very obviously, but also the war in Syria, which continues to change the continent. And of course, climate change. So I was writing in a moment where the climate bite felt like it had finally arrived in Europe. So that was the agenda. And it became this sort of sociological puzzle piece where a couple of stories came very quickly. For example, I kind of knew very, very early in the project that I wanted to write about how the winemakers in Burgundy were having their lives transformed through climate change and to really dig into who these people were. And then I found myself thinking, oh, God, I've got to find a woman age over the age of 60 who's mourning her parents and who lives in Scandinavia. Because for me, it was crucial to have this final thread going through, which is the arc of life. Because the most important thing about, you know, how you're experiencing Europe or how you're experiencing, you know, the world around you, for me, is actually kind of how old are you? Like, where are you on that Shakespearean seven ages of man? So I was sort of filling in an enormous puzzle. And, you know, that was the agenda, filling in and seeing what kind of came out of it. So there wasn't a sort of political agenda behind it. No, not really.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not a book about politics, but it does. And maybe this is just my jaundiced worldview, but it's quite a political book. I mean, as you say, it mentions a lot of the big themes of politics, whether it's sort of technology or supply chains or things like that. But also many of the chapters feature migration. So whether it's Nazdeen from Tehran or Natasha, who's now in Lithuania, these are people who've moved into Europe from somewhere else. And, you know, was there a subtext here that actually is this a book that's also just meant to show that migration enhances the richness of European life, or am I just being too cynical?
Well, you know, one of the things that was really in my head as I was writing this, so I guess that's the subtext or the subconscious or the id of the book, I'm not quite sure of my psychotherapeutic terms, is that I feel that there are several different Europes. There's the Europe of the mind, there's the Europe, and that's made up of, you know, memories of summer holidays and bits of old French cinema and stained glass windows and the smell of coffee. Then there's the Europe of politics, and that's the Europe of the Commission, Mario Draghi, Emmanuel Macron. It's the Europe of you know, my think tank work and your think tank work. And then there's the Europe that people actually live in. And I felt the first two, that Europe of the mind and the Europe of politics, have become increasingly disconnected from the Europe we live in, the way people live in Europe. So I wanted to write a book that would kind of, you know, shake people and alert people and try and help people, you know, change their own Europe of the mind and realise it was this very different place than it was a few decades ago. And one of those ways it's very different is demographically, because of these enormous waves of immigration that have come to Europe out from beyond, you know, ever since the sort of immediate aftermath of the Second World War, which have really made these very different countries and these cities very, very different places, and continue to do so. So that was one of the things that I was trying to do.
I mean, is it legitimate, though, to say that part of what Europe is are the people who are scared by these changes, the people who don't like to see these people coming into their continent, you know, that, you know, Maloney is as much part of Europe as, you know, Natasha, the AFD, are as legitimate a part of Europe as some of these people who are making hazardous crossings from Syria. It's a partial view, isn't it?
Well, I definitely agree, which is why I try to make sure that we have both in the book. So one of the chapters, there's a kind of principle behind the book. It's like, for a lot, you know, I have a kind of Jewish education, and for a very long time I kind of studied with a rabbi. And, you know, when you study the Talmud, you know, you get this never-ending chain of rabbis contradicting each other. One rabbi goes, no, this is what it is. Another goes, no, this is what it is. And what I wanted to do was create a book which gave you that sense. So each major phenomenon, really, of Europe in our times, we see it from one, two, or three different points of view. So let's have a look at Berlin. So first, the first time we come to Berlin, we see it from the point of view of Aboud. He's a Syrian refugee who's traumatized by the crossing. His wife's deeply depressed, and he works for Amazon. He's delivering packages. He's actually a black market driver. He's been forced, because of some benefit quirks, into a kind of semi-criminal position, and he hates it. He wants to get out of Berlin. He wants to get to Dubai. He doesn't even like this city. He thinks it's not even a European city. It's actually a city of a German European elite exploiting Middle Eastern and African and Eastern European migrants. And that he lives in the soft authoritarianism of the app. He can't even park in the wrong place without the app sort of trilling at him. Then we see Berlin all over again. We see it from the point of view of another Syrian migrant, actually from the same town, another Syrian refugee, rather, to the point of view of Haidar. He's a gay man. He comes to Berlin. He finds himself as a queer dancer, eventually starts doing drag with someone who's born in Israel. And for him, you know, the U-Bahn and the S-Bahn map of Berlin is a map of liberty, joy, self-discovery, and freedom. So that's that kind of almost Talmudic principle of look at that. You've got to look at something from several different points of view in order to work out what it is. And in terms of that question of, like, is an old Europe dying and is a new Europe being born? Is, you know, what does it look? What's it feel like to be in a heartland of far right voters? You know, one of the chapters that I did was from the point of view of various people in a dying village in Portugal, a village where the old Christian traditions are visibly kind of disintegrating in front of people's eyes. Only old people live there, and a few sort of people who've come from the cities trying to start their lives all over again. And I wanted to kind of show what Europe looked like for a young man who wants to go back, who wants to leave urbanity and go and try and live as a shepherd and live the kind of old ways and the folk ways. Is that even possible? Somebody who's deeply committed to the Christian faith and to making sure his daughter is kind of baptized in the church. So I wanted to really have everything in the book. I wanted to show you, you know, what it's like to be a kind of a refugee runaway from Tehran that finds themselves abandoned for dead in forest fires in Greece, but also what it's like to be somebody. You can't be more rooted in the soil than a winemaker coming from a dynasty that's been in Burgundy since there were kings in France, or indeed Napoleon was emperor of France. I wanted to kind of show Europe from both different angles to show us that it's both at the same time.
I mean, actually, before we come back to some of the bigger questions, I'm just curious how you find these people. And, you know, you've got 20 or 23 people, I think it is, in this book. How did you stumble across them? And was there a sort of longer list of people that you had that you could have included?
Well, it took 5 years. And like most books these days written by journalists, I hate to say, they're kind of free weekends in the Cotswolds and you're done. And really, it's these very thin kind of pamphlety things that are written around basically a series of campaigns. So the book is written in order to do the event, in order to often kind of lecture at kind of banks or give kind of talks afterwards. And this is written in complete kind of defiance of the horrible smart thinking trend of all books being reduced to kind of 9 quick hacks about Europe. So it took 5 years, and I found these people through every possible way that I know. I found some of them through friends, I found some of them in shelters, on the side of the road, some of them I found in kind of local newspapers, some of them I found online in kind of various kind of forums here and there. And, you know, every journalistic technique that I know or can imagine, I found them. But the journalistic technique that's interesting about how I compose them is I think of these as sort of portraiture, because I kind of thought very seriously when I was a teenager about whether I wanted to go to art school, and I have a kind of art AS level. In the end, I just wasn't talented enough. But I loved doing portrait painting. And what I love about portrait painting is you operate in these very tight constraints. If I'm going to sit down and paint your portrait, you have to go, it's me. If I was going to come and interview you for the New York Times, you could, all I need is the quotes to be accurate. You could go, well, that's not me at all. He's written me up in a completely different way. But if we're doing a portrait, it's got to be you, me, everyone's got to go, damn, that's him. That's the essence. And I'll give you an example of this. Like, one of the greatest portraits ever done is the portrait of the Duke of Wellington after he entered Madrid on his way to kind of conquer Europe. There he is, sits down with Goya, and Goya, the great Spanish painter, catches him in all his livery and his finery. But somehow there's something about the eyes where he's still this nervous boy from Dublin that can't quite believe it's really happening to him. So you've got to operate in these constraints. So the constraints that I chose for myself was, I would sit down, interview somebody, record it all on various apps, some of them even powered by AI. Then I would go away and write it up, following as close as possible the arc of their own story, because people are the best storytellers. And then I would bring it back to the subject and go, yeah, like I was the New Yorker coming and going, hello, did you actually have a kind of yellow table in your office? And I would check it with them to make sure it was... That's how they felt. And then I would get people to contribute photos. And the photos I'm really, really proud of, especially because I did take...
Photos are amazing. Because,
take, for example, I've got... In one chapter, we see Europe from the point of view of Ionu. He's a Romanian truck driver, and I think that's quite a challenging chapter, actually, for a lot of kind of Romaine-coded kind of readers. And he, you know, what's a single market? It's trade. What is trade? At the basis of trade, it's men in trucks. It's usually, in contemporary Europe, Eastern European men in trucks. And this Romanian guy is shuttling backwards and forwards across Europe, delivering things across the continent. And for him, Europe is this landscape of kind of moral hypocrisy and economic exploitation. And he was so invested in the project that he took all these incredible photos of a day or a month in the life of Ionut going from Bucharest to Rotterdam. And I couldn't have taken those photos. A photographer couldn't have taken those photos. Only he could have taken these photos. He and his girlfriend, who worked together in the cabin, of, you know, the squalor and the tightness of what it's like to sleep in there, what it's like to shit on the side of the road. And like that, I think, adds this kind of sense of reality. Because what I was really trying to get was immersion. I wanted the reader really to be immersed in this sense of what Europe is really like, the lived Europe, not the Europe of, you know, that I work on every day, which is the Europe of, you know, the latest European Council summit or the NATO summit.
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Aura and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now.
It's interesting, though. I mean, I find that sort of reading the book, it kind of did my head in, because it's so chaotic and unstructured and different and wild that, you know, as you say, from a life of trying to impose order and understand things and sort of put a nice, neat picture on this continent, this is just pure chaos. And one of the questions that sort of struck me in reading it is, you know, is there such a thing as Europe? That's one of the things it left me questioning.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about questions, because people are kind of asking me, like, you're a think tanker and you're telling us every day, well, I used to do it, like, every hour on Twitter, you're telling us what you think about this or that. You know, how come you've written a book with no narrator, no argument? And that's actually because I feel that in the world of policy, we can sometimes forget what real politics is. And for me, you know, the essence of politics is that the essence of the great political traditions, you know, of Europe, you know, socialism, conservatism, liberalism, even nationalism, they're questions of how should we live? What is the way to live? And that's all bound up in the subtitle here, which is the way we live now. Because everybody in the book wanted to be in the book because they think their story captures something about the way we live now, and they're questioning it. They're asking themselves, is this the way we want to live now? Is that Romanian truck driver's life the way he wants to live? In his case, no. Like, is, you know, Brico is a sort of, is an African refugee who's kind of fled across the Sahara to make it to Europe. He's asking himself, is this the way I want to live now? Finally arrived on the other side of the Alps in yeah. France. You know, up with Russian gas workers, they're asking themselves the same question. Is this the way that we want to live? This is the way that I want to live now? You know, drilling ever deeper as I can see climate collapse around me. So that kind of sense of questioning is very important. And is there a sense of Europe? Well, I think there is such thing as Europe. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written a book or called This Is Europe, I guess. But I think it's a very blurry thing. And I feel that, you know, Europe is not neatly delimited in the way a cartographer might have us believe in an atlas, and that, you know, Europe is very much there, but it's blurry. I feel that Europe today is, and I wanted the chapters to reflect this and the people in the book to reflect this. I don't like calling them kind of subjects or characters, but they're still there and they're still usually doing exactly what they were doing in the book. You know, they're not sort of, is, you know, Europe's blurring demographically with Asia and with Africa. Europe's blurring in a sense, politically, because Europe isn't a kind of fortress that decides its own fate. Europe is buffeted, is part of the kind of world island, I believe, is how the sort of some of the early geopolitical thinkers would put it. Like one of the themes I've tried to show in the book is how Europe has been transformed by the Syrian war. Like there's, you know, the Syrian war has transformed Europe and brought all these different people to Europe who are changing, where they live. And then I didn't want to reduce the book to just that Europe of politics, the Europe of the EU, what's commonly called Europe in, you know, the in everyday, in usual everyday political speech. I wanted to have Russia, I wanted to have Turkey, I wanted to have Britain in the book. I wanted to have stories that began in Syria and ended in Germany, or began in Tunisia and ended in France. And also I wanted to have countries like Georgia, which is, according to the cartographers, not in Europe. The cartographers would have us believe that the border of Europe is on the mountain road, the Caucasus mountain range just above. But Georgia is considered Europe by the Europe of politics, because it's deemed kind of eligible for European Union kind of membership. So I wanted that blurriness.
There is that sort of sense of Eurafrica or Eurasia. I mean, the blurriness is, you know, fuzzy boundaries.
Definitely. Because that's what I think we live in. I think, you know, there very much is a place called Europe, and a sense of communities and countries and people tied together in Europe. And I think that there's, you know, one of the things that's very important to me when we talk about Europe is we shouldn't only talk about it in the past tense. And if I was going to kind of give out a piece of paper and go to people like, what is Europe? A lot of people might come back and they might have written down cathedrals, menhirs, the sort of Schoenberg Palace. And that's thinking about Europe only in terms of the past tense. And one of the things that I think we forget, and I think we're quite bad at, is Europe's also a future. All the people in the book, all of their children are going to be European, and their grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and so on and so forth. And my children or grandchildren might marry some of their children or great-great-grandchildren or whatever. They're probably not in that particular order. And it's of great-great-grandchildren marrying children. But like it's I wanted to kind of invite people in a way to think of Europe as a future as well. And as, you know, because what Europe really is to me is it's a community of destiny, of countries that are tied together because they can't help it. You know, it's, you know, that's one of the interesting things about thinking about Britain. You know, Britain, linguistically, and some people might ask, say, culturally, some people might even still claim religiously, though that's very arguable, has more in common with, say, Australia or New Zealand, by those metrics, than it does with Bulgaria or with Poland. But it doesn't share a destiny, it doesn't share a future with those countries. Those countries' futures are tied into to Asia, a part of something completely different. You know, but Britain does, whether it's in the European Union or outside the European Union, share its destiny with you know, Bulgaria and Poland and, you know, and Estonia and, you know, with Ukraine. So that's kind of way of thinking of Europe as a future. And even when we go back to the kind of 18th century philosophers, it was very important to them when they started designing these up to now very unsuccessful plans for perpetual peace. They always included Russia in that, as they felt that Europe's future, Russia was bound into that community of destiny, whether in hostility or whether in partnership. And a lot of them would debate about whether or not Turkey was part of it, and usually choose yes, despite Turkey's religious and cultural differences. And at that time, borders that went all the way to Yemen and Basra, that empire was part of the political, you know, their vision of the political Europe, which is the community that would come together in the concert of Europe, which was had the capacity to decide the future. So all these different voices are an invitation to think about what the future of Europe is. Because I very much think Europe is a future.
I mean, interestingly enough, when you're thinking about Europe, particularly when you think about Britain, there isn't a Brit in the book, is there? Did you make a deliberate choice there?
Well, there isn't a Jew in the book either. So I thought that since I'm British and I'm Jewish, I feel that the book is British and Jewish enough by me having written it. And, you know, that's why there isn't. That's one reason why there isn't. And then the other reason is it's not kind of ideological or sociological. There's no other reason apart from that I didn't really want to write This Is London 2. You know, I felt I'd kind of written about Britain in a way. So those two feelings, one kind of very selfish about me and what I wanted to write, and another one which I felt there's like, I'm not in the book, but I'm also, you know, I'm the architect of the house. I've painted the pictures. I'm kind of an inescapable person. When anybody thinks about the book, they'll think it's written by somebody who's British. I felt that was sort of why it's not.
All right, so I'm probably overthinking it then. I wonder whether there was some deliberate plot on your part.
No, but we have like one of the characters, you know, Yonut, the Romanian truck driver, he goes on a journey to Britain. Like the chapter's about him coming all the way to Britain and the M1 and what it's like being in those kind of parking bays. And, you know, so there are people who are trying to get to Britain, I don't have a better answer for you than that.
And it's also very interesting what he says in the book about East Europeans being second rate, even in Europe, that actually this notion of sort of equality of all Europeans in the European Union being an absolute myth, that there's a rule for the French, the Germans and the Brits and a whole different set of rules for Eastern Europe. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I think it's really one of the things I like to do with this style of interviewing and journalism is there's a tendency that journalists have to censor people either because they just don't have that much space. All I'm writing a 500-word article. I've got to ask somebody about his views on the local elections, say. So you get kind of censored by default. All these the kind of rants about the just don't get in there. Or there's a tendency to sort of massage things and make things fit narratives, and that's got, I think, more pronounced actually as you've entered a more censorious era over the last few years. And what's really important for me when I sit down for these people is that they hold the mic and they're going to say a lot of things that maybe I don't agree with, maybe which is shocking. And one of the things that really comes through, there are a couple of things that really come through if you do that, that really surprised me when I started reporting like this. One is in Europe, how much anger there is amongst the Eastern European working class about their sense of being exploited by the middle classes in their own country, but also by Western Europe. And the Eastern European working class has become a pan-European experience and identity. If you come from a kind of small village or a kind of rundown part of Bucharest, you've got friends and buddies that are sort of WhatsApping you every day from like, oh yeah, here I am in a, you know, building some new complex in Malaga, and there's your mate who's up in Hamburg, and you're here and you're there. And the other thing that's very important is how intense people's spiritual feelings are, whether that's organized religion, people who are kind of Muslim or Christian, and I wanted to get this in the book, and there is a chapter about this in the book, people's spiritual feelings that can't really be captured or explained by old frameworks of religion. Like one of the chapters is about a kind of woman in Sweden who's mourning her mother and her sense of being haunted or her sense of presence. Especially if you look at the statistics, that's actually really a common European experience, to have belief in some kind of other of a world, even if you're not yourself part of the sort of Lutheran Reformed Church.
And did the process of writing the book, of talking to these people, has that changed sort of the other half of your life? Has it changed how you think about Europe politically? Has it changed how you analyse? I mean, do you keep those two bits separate? You know, the think tanker and the sort of, or has one impinged on the other?
This whole project has made me a lot more. I think we live in a particular age where there are these like intense forces of dehumanisation at work, and I don't just mean, you know, sort of horrible, nasty populists. I also mean the dehumanisation effect of technology, a kind of world where it's become de rigueur or just normal to talk about incredibly human experiences, let's say cheap labour, you know, uniquely through statistics and this very abstract way of looking. And I think we live in a kind of world where all of those soft ties of the village or the urban working class community have sort of been disappearing. And I think the Amazon delivery guy is like very symbolic for that. And that's why it was very important to me to have one. Somebody comes to my house and your house and probably most of the listeners' houses every day, knocks on the door. Hey, here's a package. Who is that person? You know, we don't know them in a way that our grandparents would have known the people on the other field, or the butcher or the baker or the candlestick.
Or the postman.
Or the postman. Literally, they know the postman or the milkman. And like the book is written in a spirit of trying to kind of show people, and I wouldn't be as arrogant to say to reconnect them. But I've come out of this whole process a lot more alarmed. It's become a lot more important to my analytical politics, the non-headline making exploitation of hard work for low pay in contemporary Europe. That's become a lot more urgent to me, in thinking about kind of labour conditions and working conditions. And I'll admit, it's not something. You know, somebody who was drawn analytically to kind of, you know, extremes, points in the data, would often look at things in terms of curves. That is not something that had jumped out to me until I'd done this fieldwork as something really wrong with the way we live now. So I guess that's come out as very important to me. And the other thing that came out as very important to me is that the sense of climate crisis for normal Europeans is much more elevated and much more acute than it is in the political Europe. And really, over the last few years, we've crossed, you know, I don't want to say a Rubicon, because that implies action and Caesar moving to take Rome, but we've crossed some kind of, you know, sort of barometer point where there is a low level panic. And this is something that people really wanted to talk about. So yeah, but those two things have become much more important to me analytically as a think tanker, kind of exploitation of low wage workers and, you know, the everyday effects of climate crisis in Europe. And that's actually one of the things that made me switch a lot of what I do at the Atlantic Council away from kind of straight geopolitics to doing a kind of decarbonisation project, which I do now, which is actually looking at how some of those two things join up: climate crisis and how to create good jobs.
The word that kept springing to my mind throughout the book is empathy. I mean, it's literally what the book is, isn't it? It is looking at the world through other people's eyes. And I mean, in that sense, you know, going back to something I said earlier, it is intensely political, isn't it? Because it is the opposite of othering. It is, you know, hearing their thoughts, hearing their voices, seeing how they see things, which is just so different to how politics is done, which is telling us.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's a principle that's kind of very important to me, which is a kind of Jewish way of looking at things, but I think it's the same for all religions and all moral structures, which is the sacredness of life. And what I wanted to do in the book was to show each of these different lives and viewpoints as kind of sacred in their own way, and for the reader to have the experience of meeting them like I had, just as if they were sitting with them and listening to them tell their story. And the other thing that was quite important to me is, actually, I'm not a politician, and I don't have to pretend that there aren't contradictions here between people mourning the vanishing of a way of life in Portugal that's millennia old, and people desperately crossing the Mediterranean looking for a new life. I'm not going to pretend to you that there are contradictions here. So those were, I really want, you know, one of the things that I love about the journalistic side of my life is that ability, is the sort of ability to sort of empathize and to meet people from all different backgrounds and to just listen to them and to have them share their stories with me. And that's one of the reasons that I decided to shoot the narrator in the book, because I find that when there's a narrator, if you're, you know, Paul Theroux wandering around, you mediate and you judge these people. Maybe you're judged well or you're judged badly, but basically people like Paul Theroux and, you know, Fierce Night Ball, because they sort of wandered around the third world sort of making fun of people. And I just didn't want that. I wanted people to have the experience of almost being the journalist for themselves. You meet these people and you go away and make up your own mind. And I think we live in a cultural moment that's like super infantilizing, where, and I think that, you know, dying news media and dying publishers are so worried about getting the maximum amount of clicks that people are sort of dumbing down what they do. So everything has to be written in this, you know, very basic way of like, we're on a beach in Syria and the Syrian, we're in the beach in Greece and here are the refugees. And the Syrian civil war started in 2011. And I just kind of wanted to see what would happen if you just threw that away and wrote in a different way.
I mean, perhaps the highest praise I can give you is, you know, I finished this book feeling I had met these people, which is really, really good to think. But I'm afraid we've run out of time. My God, doesn't time fly? That was really, really... Well, listen, for those listening, let me remind you, the book is called This Is Europe, The Way We Live Now by Ben Judah. Go out, buy it, read it, enjoy the photos. Ben, it's been utterly fascinating talking to you. It really is a sort of... It's an original and fascinating book, and I really enjoyed this chance to chat to you about it. So thank you.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure.